Hello, I'm Noim. I'm a computer scientist, and I wanted to give a brief introduction to symbolic execution, which is an automated software testing technique. And this talk is really intended to be a foundational introduction to symbolic execution. So I will spend a little bit of extra time on background information and motivation to make sure that we are all on the same page. And since symbolic execution concerns itself with software testing, the first thing that we need to collectively establish is what is software testing even? And conceptually speaking, the goal of software testing is to ensure that a newly written or maybe even existing piece of code works as expected. And in order to do that, what we commonly do is we test our code by comparing the expected output to the actually generated output for our code using a set of selected inputs. So in C, this might look like as follows. We have a function that we want to test called myfunc. And this myfunc needs two function parameters, input 1 and input 2. And then we would test this function by feeding it two specific instantiations of input 1 and input 2. And then this function has an output. And in this case, the output is the return value. And we would compare the return value of that function against some sort of defined expected output. And then we would wrap this entire thing in an assertion. And then if this comparison fails, then the assertion fails, and thereby our test suite fails. Now, the problem with software testing using this established method is that we need to select appropriate test inputs. So we need to figure out which inputs do we need to use in order to test our function. And for this reason, software testing is mainly a manual process. So we, as developers, need to think about appropriate inputs and then write the test case invoking our to-be-tested code using these inputs. And because it's a manual process, there's usually a significant amount of time that is spent doing software engineering on software testing. And therefore, it's very important to figure out at what point have I written enough tests for my newly added code? At what point have I written enough tests for my function? And determining when a piece of software has been sufficiently tested is a bit challenging. But it's a very important question to answer, because only then I know when I can stop adding more test cases for my function. And the established method to judge the quality of a test suite is the utilization of coverage metrics. And coverage metrics differ with respect to a coverage target. A coverage target may be line coverage, so how many lines of my function, how many total lines have I covered using my tests. A different, very popular coverage target is branch coverage. So my function has a specific amount of branches, and then I check how many of these branches have I triggered using the test inputs that I have selected for my test suite. And branch coverage is, at least in my view, probably one of the most popular coverage metrics used today for software engineering. So I briefly wanted to illustrate it a bit more using an example. And here we have an exemplary C function called myfunc. And that C function takes two function parameters, A and B. And then it has two branches, the first one from line 4 to line 7, which depends on the first function parameter. And then a second branch in line 9 to 12, which depends on the second function parameter. And then in order to achieve 100% branch coverage on this code, it has four branches in line 5, in line 7, in line 10, in line 12. We need to trigger all of these branches using test inputs. So first suitable test input to this function would be we invoke it with A equals true and B equals false. And then we would trigger the first branch in line 5 because A is true. And we would trigger the second branch in line 12 because B is false. And with this test case, we already triggered half of the branches in our function. So in this case, we have 50% branch coverage. Then we can write a second test case for this function, where we set A to false and B to true. And with this test case, we trigger the remaining two branches that we haven't triggered with the first test input. And now we have 100% branch coverage in our function. Using two test cases, we have covered all branches in our function. Our function has four branches, and each of them has been tested using these two test cases. However, there's one major problem with this function, and that is it has a diff by zero bug. And this diff by zero bug occurs when A and B have the same value, which isn't the case with the two test cases that we are using here. So if, for example, A is true and B is true, then we set X, a local variable, to zero. And then later on, because B is also true, we would divide 5 by X. And X is now zero, and thereby we have a division by zero bug. And depending on your programming language and language runtime, division by zero is usually some sort of runtime exception, and that's something that we don't want to happen in production. But according to branch coverage, using these two inputs, we would have tested the function sufficiently. Nonetheless, our tests miss an important bug in the function. And that is the case because branch coverage views every branch in isolation. It does not consider previous branch evaluations that we, which branch have we taken for a previous if statement. So therefore, for branch coverage, it kind of masks this problem. And the solution to this problem is to use a different coverage target. As I said in the beginning, there are different coverage metrics with different coverage targets, and branch coverage concerns itself with the coverage target branches. And a different thing that we can do, which would help us discover this sort of bug, is to use execution paths as a coverage target. And execution paths include the order in which we have taken the branches in our function. An execution path essentially specifies for each branch in our software and the test, which branch have we taken. So have we taken the true branch or the false branch of an if statement? And then if we have a sequence of these Boolean values, then we have an execution path. And this is best visualized through a control flow graph. This is what we see on the right-hand side of this slide. So in an execution, in a control flow graph, the nodes are basic blocks, so essentially code that once entered is unconditionally executed. And then the nodes have edges between each other to illustrate the control flow within the function. And nodes with two outgoing edges have a conditional jump. So we can either take the one edge or the left edge or the right one. So for example, here, this if statement has two outgoing edges because it depends on the condition A. So we can either go left or we can go right, depending on whether the branch condition is true or false. And using this control flow graph that we see on the right-hand side, we can think about the execution paths that we have through our function. And the first one, that is the one that triggers the bug that we saw on the previous slide, is that both branches evaluate to true. In this case, the red path would be the one that we take through our function, and we would run into this diff by zero bug here. And then there are three more execution paths. The other one is the first branch is true, and the second branch evaluates to false. The third one is the first branch evaluates to false, the second one evaluates to true. And then the last branch is both if statements evaluate to false. And so in total, in our exemplary function, we have four execution paths. And with these test inputs, we would trigger these four execution paths. And in order to achieve 100% path coverage instead of 100% branch coverage, we would need four test inputs for our function in order to achieve 100% path coverage. Now, the problem with path coverage is that the amount of execution paths, and thereby the amount of test cases that we need to write in order to achieve high path coverage, grows exponentially with the number of if statements in our code. So in our exemplary code, we have four if statements and two if statements, and 2^2 is 4. And therefore, we have four execution paths in our function. But if we, for example, have 8 if statements in our function, then we have 2^8, 256 execution paths that we would have to test in order to achieve 100% path coverage. And that means that we would have to spend a lot of time manually writing test cases. And this is a bit of a challenge with respect to path coverage. Writing test cases manually becomes impractically, becomes impractical if we want to achieve high path coverage because there are so many paths that we need to cover. So that's annoying. The other issue with path coverage is that some execution paths may not be feasible. They may not be reachable at all. So an example for that would be the following sequence of if statements. Here we first test if a variable A is greater than 8, and then afterwards we test, is it smaller than 5? And naturally, it's not possible for A to have a value that is both greater than 8 and smaller than 5 at the same time. It's just not logically possible. Therefore, if we have such a sequence in our software and our test, then it would not be possible to find an execution path where both of these branches evaluate to true, because A cannot be greater than 5 and smaller than greater than 8 and smaller than 5 at the same time. So we cannot come up with a test input which triggers an execution path where both of these if statements evaluate to true. So even though it grows exponentially, the amount of paths that we need to cover, some of these paths may not be triggerable using a test input. And if we want to achieve 100% path coverage, then we need to figure out which execution paths are actually reachable and which ones are not reachable. And in order to address these two problems, manual test generation becomes very labor-intensive, and some execution paths may not be feasible. We don't want to write our test cases manually. Instead, we want to automate the generation of our test inputs for our software testing approach. And specifically, we want to automate our test input generation with this path coverage metric in mind. And this requires us to reason about the satisfiability of branch conditions, because branch conditions are where execution paths diverge, where either we can take the left or the right edge, depending on whether or not the branch condition can or cannot be true and false. And conceptually, branch conditions are just logical formulas, right? Such as A and B or C. And what we need to do in order to figure out if it's possible for this branch condition to be true, we need to find a satisfying assignment for these variables. So we need to figure out which value do I have to assign to my variable A, B, and C in order for the branch condition to evaluate to true and in order for the branch condition to evaluate to false. And if it's not possible to find such an assignment, if no such assignment exists, then we know that this branch condition cannot evaluate to true or respectively to false. That is, we know that this branch is not reachable. And if you study computer science, then you might recognize this problem, because it's the Boolean satisfiability problem in disguise. This is a very central problem to theoretical computer science. And the idea behind the Boolean satisfiability problem is that we have a formula, a logical formula F, and a propositional logic. And the output of an algorithm solving the Boolean satisfiability problem is either a variable assignment for this logical formula F so that the formula evaluates to true, or if no such assignment exists, then a SAT solver, an algorithm implementing this problem or attempting to solve this problem, would give us a proof that it's definitely not possible for such an assignment to exist. For example, for A greater than 8 and A smaller than 5, we would get a proof that it's not possible to find a satisfying assignment for this logical formula. Here's an example of what that might look like. So we have a formula F, which uses two Boolean variables, x1 and x2, and then performs several logic operations on them, namely AND, OR, and NOT. And then we are asking, hey, is it possible for this formula F to evaluate to true? And in this case, it is possible for F to evaluate to true, namely when x1 has the value true and x2 has the value true. So this would be a satisfying assignment for this formula. And as I said, there are tools out there which attempt to solve these problems, algorithms which attempt to find such a satisfying assignment, such as this one, for a given logical formula. And these tools are called SAT solvers. The problem with SAT solving is that it's computationally very intensive to find a satisfying assignment for such a formula. And known SAT solving algorithms have an exponential worst case complexity. However, because it is such a central problem for theoretical computer science, there are several optimizations and heuristics that have been developed over the past decades in order to decide this problem more efficiently. And modern SAT solvers are therefore able to usually deal with formulas that have thousands of variables and constraints, so they have gotten quite efficient at it, even though the worst case complexity for deciding this problem is still exponential. there's also an additional problem, and that is that SAT concerns itself with propositional logic. So our variables, they are only Boolean variables. They can be true or false. We cannot represent integers or bit vectors in SAT directly, and we only have logic operations in SAT, AND or NOT. And in programming languages, for branch conditions, we also require arithmetic operations. So for example, to decide something like, is A plus B greater than C? We need a notion of what does the plus operator do. And in SAT, we cannot do this directly because we only have logic operations and Boolean values. And for reasoning about a real world programming language code, we also need arithmetic operations such as addition, subtraction, multiplication, and so on. And this is in fact a problem for many verification tasks, and therefore there is a popular abstraction that is defined on top of SAT, and that is SMT. And SMT is short for satisfiability modulo theories, and SMT essentially gives us additional high-level theories such as the theory of integers that are then mapped to SAT, but we don't have to worry about doing that ourselves. And a high-level theory that is particularly beneficial for our kind of reasoning about branch conditions problem is the theory of bit vectors. And in the theory of bit vectors, our values are not just Boolean values, but fixed size bit vectors with the corresponding arithmetic operations. So the theory of bit vectors, for example, gives us an addition operation with the correct overflow behavior, or a multiplication operation with the correct overflow behavior. And in order to, so similar to SAT, the question with SMT is also, I have this formula in SMT, and I want to know if there is a satisfying assignment for this formula. And in order to express this, these kind of formulas using these higher level theories, there is a standard known as SMTlib. And SMTlib just allows us to express our input formulas, and we can then pass our formulas in this SMTlib format to an SMTlib to an SMT solver, such as set3, and the solver will then tell us what a satisfying assignment for involved variables might look like, or it will tell us there is no satisfying assignment for the formula that you have given me. And just to give you a feel for what this SMTlib format looks like, I put a little example on the right-hand side of the slide. It's a little verbose because SMTlib is a standard based on S expressions. So thus we have all these parentheses here. But essentially, I can define three variables in SMTlib, for example, using declare const, and then I have to give these variables a type. In this case, I say I have a variable x, and variable x is a 32-bit bit vector. And then I can define logical formulas that make use of this variable somehow. So here we have a logical formula where a multiplication of x with a fixed value is performed, then a remainder is calculated, and then we compare that output of these arithmetic operations to another constant value, and then we can ask the solver, hey, is it possible for this particular formula to be true? And then the solver would give us an assignment so that the formula becomes true. But we don't have to understand this example in its depth. This is just giving you an intuition of what the input format looks like. And this brings me now finally to the topic of this talk, namely symbolic execution. We now have the background stuff that we need in order to reason about branch conditions in a program. And symbolic execution now connects this existing work on SMT solvers with program verification, or uses it for program verification, program testing. And what symbolic execution allows us to do, it allows us to treat selected program variables, for example, a local variable or a function parameter, as a free SMTlib variable. So we can say, hey, I want this value to be a symbolic SMTlib variable. And conceptually, these symbolic SMTlib variables, they always refer to a set of possible concrete values. So normally, when we execute a program, we use concrete values. So we invoke a function with one concrete value, such as 5, 10, a string such as foo. And with symbolic execution, our values would now be a set of possible concrete values at a given time during program execution. So for example, all values that are greater than 5, or all values that are smaller than 10. And these symbolic variables are continuously constrained during program execution to match the constraints that are enforced by the execution path. So for example, if I have a branch in my program where I check is A greater than 8, and A is my symbolic variable, then initially, when I have no constraints, that branch might be true. But from that point onward, A can only refer to values that are greater than 8. And to illustrate this, I have another example. So here we have a C function that takes one parameter, a signed integer n. And it has two if statements. The first one checks if n is smaller than 0 and then performs a calculation on n. And the other one then checks if n is smaller than or equal to 0. And if it is, then it aborts program execution. So this in line 8 would be an error case that ideally we don't want to reach. And now if we would employ symbolic execution to test this piece of software, then we would declare this local variable n that is passed as a function parameter to sumfunc. We would declare that as a symbolic variable. And initially, n can be any value, so any value that can be represented in a signed integer. And then we would go through the branch conditions in this function. And the first branch condition that we encounter is if n smaller than 0. And let us now assume that we want to explore the false path first, so where n is not smaller than 0. And at this point, we would then go to the SMT solver and ask the SMT solver, hey, we have this symbolic variable n, and we would like to know, is it possible for n to be greater than or equal to 0, because we want to explore the false branch denegation. And since we have no constraints on n, n can be any value, so yes, it is possible for n to be greater than or equal to 0, and thereby for the branch to be false. And then we would execute the next statement in line 5, we would assign n to 1, and then we would encounter the next if statement in our function, the one in line 7, and here we ask, is it possible for n to be smaller than or equal to 0? And we have just set n to 1, so we have an additional constraint now that n is 1, and we would now ask the solver, is it possible for n to be greater than or equal to 0, and for 1 to be greater than 0? And this is the case, and this is the false branch. So in this case, we would not trigger the abort, and we are good. And then we also have to consider the case where the second if statement becomes true. In this case, we would have to ask the solver, is it possible for n to be greater than or equal to 0, and for 1 to be less than or equal to 0? And that's not the case. And that is very good for us, because it means that for the second if statement in line 7, the true case is not reachable, it's not possible. And this is exactly what we want, because we don't want to trigger the abort statement in line 8. So for the false case and the true and false case for the second if statement, we are fine. And now we just have to explore the remaining cases in the program, because again, we are concerned with path coverage here. So we want to iterate over all execution paths. And the execution path that we have not yet considered is the one where the first if statement evaluates to true. And then we again have the second if statement where we have to reason about two branches. So first of all, it is possible for the first if statement to be true. And then we would perform a calculation on n where we multiply n by minus 1. And using that calculation, we would then have to evaluate the second if statement in line 7. And here we would ask, is it possible for n to be greater than 0? That's the constraint enforced by the true branch of the first if statement. And then additionally, is it possible for n times minus 1 to be greater than 0? Because we are concerned here with the false case for the second if statement. And that is also possible. So this is yet another execution path that we can trigger in our function. And then there's one more execution path that we have to look into, and that is the one where both if statements evaluate to true. We have to figure out, is it possible for both if statements to evaluate to true? And in order for that to be the case, n would have to be smaller than 0, and n times minus 1 would have to be smaller than or equal to 0. And this is, in fact, also possible. And that is the case because of the signed integer representation that is used by modern computer architectures, namely 2's complement. So 2's complement is a way to represent signed integers in a computer to differentiate between positive and negative integers. And the thing with 2's complement is that the number range is not symmetric. In fact, there are more negative than positive integers in 2's complement. So for some negative integers, there is no positive representation. In fact, if we multiply the most negative signed integer by -1, then the result is still a negative integer. And this particular case, where both if statements evaluate to true, that is possible when n is the most negative signed integer. In this case, we would reach our abort and our function would crash. And the solver would now tell us, hey, a satisfying assignment for this execution path where both if statements evaluate to true is n equals the most negative signed integer. Then both if statements would evaluate to true and we would trigger this bug in our function. And in total, our function thereby has 3 execution paths. This one is not reachable because the condition is not logically satisfiable, because it's not possible for 1 to be smaller than or equal to 0. But for the other 3 execution paths, the conditions are satisfiable, and therefore we have 3 execution paths in our function. And we would reason about, or we would check that these execution paths are feasible and are possible by asking a solver to find a satisfying assignment for these logic conditions. And for 3 of them, it finds a satisfying assignment, and for this one down here, it does not find a satisfying assignment because it's just logically not possible to satisfy this formula. And in reality, so I used pseudo notation a bit here in the tree. In reality, all of these logical conditions have to be expressed in this SMTlib format that we saw on the earlier slide, and we would have to translate the C code to the SMTlib formula somehow. And as part of this translation, we, for example, have to map signed integers in C to an equivalent SMTlib type. And the equivalent SMTlib type here would be a fixed size bit vector. But we need to figure out what is the size of an int. Is it a 32-bit bit vector? Is it a 46-bit bit vector? And this mapping of C code to SMTlib for complex programming languages like C is very complicated because of all the complex semantics and edge cases that we have in the C standard. It's quite a large PDF. And we also ideally want to employ symbolic execution not just for C code, but also for other fancy programming languages like Rust or Zig or Go. And therefore, if we were to translate the C code directly to SMTlib, then we could only use this technique for C and not for other programming languages. And in order to resolve this challenge, we don't directly translate C code to SMTlib. Instead, we use a concept from the compiler design domain, namely intermediate representations. So in compiler design, we have the problem that we support different machine code backends. We want to generate machine code for different architectures, such as PowerPC or ARM or x68. And then also, we want our compiler to perform optimizations in order to make the code run as fast as possible. And we want these optimizations to be applicable to these different architectures. Therefore, we don't want to optimize the machine code. And compilers, therefore, have an intermediate representation that they perform the optimizations on. This is the component in the middle. And compiler designers usually differentiate compiler front ends, which translate a programming language such as C or C++ or Rust or Go into such an intermediate representation. Then they perform the optimizations on this intermediate representation. And then they have a compiler backend, which is responsible for generating the machine code based on this intermediate representation. For example, a compiler backend for x68, for ARM, for PowerPC. And different compilers have different intermediate representations. A very popular intermediate representation is LLVMER. This is the intermediate representation used by the LLVM compiler infrastructure. Other compilers have other intermediate representations. GCC has one that is called Gimple. But LLVMER is particularly interesting because it's emitted by the Clang compiler for C code. But for example, it's also emitted by the Rust compiler for the Rust programming language, or by the Zig compiler, at least at the moment, for the Zig programming language. And the way to think about this intermediate representation is that it's essentially a portable assembly language to some degree. So here is an example LLVMER representation of a factorial function. And it looks very much like assembly code. And bringing this back to symbolic execution, the idea with respect to using these kinds of languages for symbolic execution is that instead of generating these SMTlib expressions that we need in order to communicate with the solver, we don't do this generation directly based on a programming language like C or Rust or Go, but instead we generate first the intermediate representation, and then we translate this intermediate representation to an SMTlib representation, because the intermediate representation has simpler semantics than a C compiler. One example where this can be briefly illustrated is that all integers have a fixed width. So our factorial function takes a 32-bit signed integer as a parameter and not just an int, as we saw in the C code, where we don't know how many bytes are in an int without any platform-specific reasoning. And intermediate representations are very central to symbolic execution because the SMTlib is generated from this intermediate representation. And there are two ways we can do that. The first one is source-based symbolic execution, where we already have the source code available. And then we can go ahead and we can tell the compiler, dear compiler, please give me an intermediate representation of my program instead of compiling it directly to a binary. Then we get the intermediate representation from the compiler. And then we can symbolically execute this intermediate representation by mapping selected expressions and selected branch conditions to SMTlib formulas and then ask a solver to find a satisfying assignment for these branch conditions. It's also possible to do symbolic execution of binary code when we don't have the source code available. So, for example, when a library is only supplied in binary form by a vendor, and we would still like to test or reason about that binary. In that case, the compiler backend would generate binary code from an intermediate representation, and then there's tooling that's very similar to decompilation tooling that takes as an input the binary code and returns as an output an intermediate representation of that binary code. And that process is usually referred to as binary lifting. So we take binary code and we transform it back into an intermediate representation such as LLVMER, and then we could again symbolically execute this intermediate representation by mapping it to SMTlib, and that allows the symbolic execution of binary code. That is the brief theory part that I wanted to go through. So ideally, we have some understanding now what SMT is, what SMTlib is, and how SMTlib is generated for source code, and how it helps generating test cases by covering execution paths. I now wanted to illustrate how we can put this into praxis. And there are a few existing tools which implement some of these ideas. Two popular ones are CLI and Enga. CLI does source-based symbolic execution of the LLVMER compiler infrastructure. It's a bit of a monolithic C++ code base, so it's primarily intended to be used through command line tooling that they provide. In contrast to that, there's also a very modular Python library called Enga, which focuses more on binary and not on source analysis. And Enga symbolically executes Volgrind VEX, which is the intermediate representation used by the popular Volgrind tool, which is often used to check for memory safety errors in C code. And Enga is a modular Python library, so you can use it more easily to build your own analysis tooling because it's not just a command line tool. There are also a lot of alternative implementations out there. Just put a few of them on this slide. So there's BINSEC, which is an OCaml framework for binary analysis using symbolic execution. There's also OV, which uses WebAssembly as the intermediate representation based on which the SMTlib is generated. So if you're interested more in web technologies, then OV might be worth looking into. And then there's Crosshair, which is more of a high-level property testing Python framework, similar to Hypothesis, but it uses symbolic execution under the hood. I wanted to briefly demonstrate the capabilities of CLI, because it's a very mature and, at least in parts, well-documented tool. And in order to present the capabilities of CLI, I prepared a little live demo. And in this live demo, we want to test a base 46 implementation using symbolic execution. And for those of you who are not familiar with Base 46, it's essentially an ASCII encoding scheme for binary data. So I can feed it arbitrary binary data, and it will give me an ASCII representation of it. And we want to symbolically execute an existing open source Base 46 implementation in this demo, which is written in C and taken from the Riot operating system. And we want to show a specific property that should hold for this Base 46 implementation. The Base 46 implementation has two central functions. The first one is ENCODE, which I can pass arbitrary data, and then it gives me a representation of that data in the Base 46 format. And then the second important function of this Base 46 implementation is Base 46 decode, which I can give Base 46 encoded data, and it will give me back the original data. And so the property that we want to show here is that if I encode data using Base 46 and then decode it again, we should get the original data as an outcome. This is the property that ideally should hold on all execution paths through the Base 46 implementation. And the goal now is to show that this property holds for the Base 46 implementation by using this open source LLVMER based CLI tool that I mentioned on the previous slide. And for this, I have a little live demo that I wanted to go through. So this demo stuff, it's available on in a Git repository. I have the link on the last slide, so you can also experiment with it further at home if you want to. And the most important part of the demo is, of course, the Base 46 implementation. So in the header file, we have the prototype of the ENCODE function right here in line 124. And then there's also a corresponding decode function here in line 147. And then within the file base46.c, we have the implementation of these two functions. And I don't think we have time to go through the whole code, but it's roughly, roughly 300 to 400 lines of C code. And as I said, this is an existing open source implementation. I've written this. I have not written this myself. What I have written myself is what is called a test harness. So I have to now describe how do I test these two functions using symbolic execution. Where do I insert my symbolic variables? And this test harness is the main function that we see here. The first thing that we do in the main function is we declare an input buffer. This is the data that we would like to encode using Base 46. And then on this input buffer, we call the Base 46 encode function, and that writes an encoding of our input into the character buffer here called in. And then we pass this character buffer to the Base 46 decode function, which then decodes this data again and writes the decoded Base 46 data to this out variable here, again a character buffer of 128 bytes. And then down here we specify the properties that we would like to see. The first property that we would like to see is that once decoded, the size of the decoded character buffer should be the same as our original input size. That is the first assertion here in line 355. And then additionally, we would like to have the output of the Base 46 decode function satisfy this additional property, namely that it's bytewise equal to our originally to our original input. And now for symbolic execution, we have to specify what data should be symbolic. What data should we reason about in order to explore execution paths? And this can be done using a special function provided by CLI, which is called CLI make symbolic. And CLI make symbolic takes a pointer to a memory region and the size of that memory region, and then it converts the entire memory region to symbolic bytes. So it treats each byte in that memory region as a symbolic 8-bit byte vector. And that's basically it for the test setup. And we can now execute this test setup and check if this property holds on our execution paths. The first thing that we need to do, because CLI does the symbolic execution based on LLVMER, we need to transform our C program to an equivalent LLVMER representation. And as I mentioned in the beginning, LLVMER is the intermediate representation used by the LLVM compiler infrastructure, and Clang is the C compiler of the LLVMER compiler infrastructure. And Clang has a command line option that is called emit LLVM, and that causes the Clang compiler to not generate a binary, an object file, or whatever, but to generate a representation of our program in this intermediate language. And this program is written to the file base46.ll. And this is the verbose LLVMER representation of our original C code. We don't have to go through it because it's auto-generated. But this is essentially the portable pseudo-assembly language that we saw on an earlier slide. This is what LLVMER for our C program looks like. And we can now use CLI to symbolically execute this LLVMER representation and check that the property that we specified in our main function in our test harness holds for all execution paths. And for this purpose, I have a little makefile with a convenience target, makesim for makesimulate. And if we run that, then CLI's command line tooling will be invoked with a bunch of command line options that I find useful for this example. And then CLI will translate the LLVMER to an SMTLib representation and ask the solver continuously, hey, is this branch satisfiable? Is this branch satisfiable? And so on and so forth. And it will enumerate all execution paths through this program. In this case, in order to make sure that the live demo completes in time, I have reduced the input size quite a bit. And CLI, based on this very small input size, has found 75 execution paths through our program. And on each of these paths, a property that we defined holds. There is no error. So that means that for this fixed input size, we now have a proof that on all execution paths that are reachable for this fixed size input, the base 46 decode encode property holds. We can now also use the CLI tooling to look at the test cases that CLI has generated. Because we have 75 execution paths through our function, CLI has generated 75 test cases. And for each of them, it generates a bunch of files. The most important one is the ktest file, which is a CLI-specific format to store the input value required to trigger this execution path. And using the ktest tool, we can take a look at this format. And here, the tooling tells us which bytes would be required to trigger this specific execution path. And we could now, for example, generate test cases automatically from these 75 test files. We also see here that, as I said, I reduced the input size quite significantly to only 2 bytes. Another thing that might be worth looking at is the SMTLib that CLI generates formal reasoning about branch conditions. This is the stuff that it feeds to an SMT solver, in this case set free, in order to determine is a specific branch satisfiable. And again, I don't think it's useful to go through this in super detail, but this is the SMTLib representation that it uses to reason about the second branch condition. And this is just fed to an SMT solver like set free, and the solver will tell us, is this satisfiable or not? And if it's satisfiable, it will give us a variable assignment. And from that variable assignment, CLI generates these ktest files that we saw earlier. Now, one thing that I also wanted to demonstrate, because it's quite boring when we don't get an error, we can, of course, also intentionally inject a bug into our base 46 implementation. So for example, here, we can change the mapping of a specific base 46 character. And if we then recompile the program and execute it with CLI again, then after a short while, CLI will tell us that the assertion does not hold because I just intentionally modified the C code in order to inject a bug into the C code. And then CLI will tell us, hey, there's an assertion failure. And the assertion that fails is out size equals input size. And it will give us a bunch of more debug information as to where that assertion failure occurs. And we can then again use the CLI ktest tool in order to look at the specific input that triggers the execution path that contains this assertion failure. In this case, it's encountered on execution path number 7. So with this input value to our base46 encode and decode functions, we could reproduce the assertion failure, and we could now debug our program using this input, using GDB or whatever, to figure out where the bug is occurring. So yeah, that is just a small introduction to symbolic execution to demonstrate how you can use CLI and how you have to set up Clang in order to have it emit LLVMER. I now also wanted to briefly speak about the limitations of symbolic execution. As we saw in the example, I reduced the input size quite significantly to only 2 bytes. And because of that, in this example, we were able to enumerate all possible execution paths based on an input buffer of this fixed size. And therefore, we have a proof that with the fixed size of 2 bytes, this assertion always holds. But for more complex programs and for higher input sizes, this is not always feasible in practice because of 2 major problems. The first one is state explosion. So as we learned in the beginning, the amount of execution paths through a program grows exponentially with the amount of branches in the code. So you quickly run into a situation where you have thousands or millions of execution paths that you would have to cover. And that just takes a while. So several days, several months, depending on how many execution paths you have. And then an additional scalability challenge is the solving time. So I said in the beginning that solvers have gotten quite efficient at solving formulas with thousands of variables. But at some point, it just takes the solver a few seconds or a few minutes even to solve a constraint. And that, of course, also impacts the scalability, because at some point, you spend a lot of time waiting for the solver to give you an answer to your satisfiability problem. However, for medium complexity programs, it works surprisingly well. You can also increase the input size for the base46 example by quite a significant margin. It just then takes 30 minutes or an hour until it enumerated all execution paths. But the beauty of symbolic execution is it does that by itself. It doesn't need manual intervention. So you can, for example, run it on a server and just let it run overnight. There are also various optimizations and techniques that help improve the scalability of symbolic execution. There's one optimization that is particularly beneficial to this example, which is documented in the README for this repository. And if you turn that on, then it will speed up this process significantly. Additionally, it helps to employ divide and conquer. So not test the program in its entirety, but instead divide it into smaller components that you then test in isolation. And there are also additional optimizations that people have tried in the research literature to speed up symbolic execution. A popular one is combining symbolic execution with fuzzing, using fuzzing to explore the program in its breadth, and then using symbolic execution to go into the depth of the program by solving specific branch conditions. And to further drive home the point that symbolic execution actually works for real software, I wanted to briefly discuss evaluation results of the original CLI paper. And in the original CLI paper, they evaluated their tooling on Nucoutils and BusyBox. And what they did is they symbolically executed the various programs that are supplied by BusyBox and Coutils, such as LS, Grep, and whatnot. And then they compared the coverage that the existing test suite written by the Coutils developers achieve for these programs with the coverage that the automatically generated test cases using automatically generated using symbolic execution achieve on these programs. And the results are presented here in this table. And in this table, we have several coverage categories. So such as 100% coverage, 90 to 100% coverage, 80 to 90 coverage. And then the table tells us how many program tests fall in this coverage category. And the automatically generated CLI tests, 16 of them, so for 16 Coutils programs, achieve 100% coverage. And for the manually written tests that have been created over the years by the Coutils developers, only one of them achieves 100% coverage. And we see a similar story with the other higher up coverage categories. So 40 CLI generated tests achieve 90 to 100% coverage, and only 6 of the manually developer created tests achieve 90 to 100% coverage. And if we look at the average coverage per app, then 90.9% is what CLI achieves using the automatically generated tests. And for the manually written one that have been created using manual labor by the Nucoi Tools developers, only 68.4% average coverage per app are achieved for the manually written tests. And that's a very interesting result, because the manually written tests are worse in terms of coverage achieved, and at the same time they require more work to create them, because it's a manual effort. And for CLI, there is no manual effort. The tests are automatically generated, the test inputs are automatically generated. Nonetheless, it even achieves higher coverage than the manually written test suit, which is a very astonishing result, and also shows that CLI is applicable to real-world code, such as GNU/Coyote Tools or BusyBox. Okay, that brings me to the end and the outlook of this talk. So we so far primarily talked about exploring a program in its entirety using symbolic execution, so enumerating all possible execution paths. However, it's also possible to use symbolic execution for partial exploration of a program, in which case it becomes more similar to fuzzing, and we would only explore a subset of all possible execution paths. And when doing that, a program component that becomes very important is the path selection algorithm employed by a symbolic execution tool. So on this slide, we have the state after partial exploration of a program. We have found, or we have encountered, two if statements. And for each of these if statements, we have only explored the execution paths where both of them are false. And now we can make a decision here as to which path to explore next. We can either explore the path where the first if statement becomes true, or we can explore the path where the first if statement is still false and then the second one becomes true. And now we need to make a decision. Which path do we explore next? Do we want to explore the program in its breadth? In this case, we would pick this execution path right here. Or do we want to explore it in its depth? And then we would explore this execution path right here. So would we use a depth-first search or breadth-first search? And the component deciding which path to explore next is the path selector. And if we only explore a program partially, then it becomes very important that we explore the execution paths where we believe it to be most likely to encounter a bug. And we can also instrument the path selector with heuristics in order to make it more likely to trigger these execution paths where a bug might occur. So we could, for example, say we want to prioritize execution paths where we measured the most memory accesses so far, in the hope that more memory accesses make it more likely for an out-of-bounds memory access to occur, for example. Speaking of out-of-bounds memory accesses, another topic that I briefly wanted to touch on is error detection. So far we enumerated execution paths, and then for each execution path that we reason about, we need to check, does this execution path constitute an error case? So is there an error occurring on this execution path? And for the examples that we used so far, errors were mainly assertion failures or just abort calls. However, similar to fuzzing, we can also use CLI to find non-functional bugs in our program. For example, we can instrument our program using the undefined behavior sanitizer, UBSAN, and then CLI would be able to find undefined behavior occurring in C code, such as integer overflows. In addition to that, CLI is also able to find memory errors, such as out-of-bounds reads, out-of-bounds writes. And this is very similar to fuzzing, where you would also, for example, use address sanitizer to instrument your program to find memory safety violations, and CLI can also do that for you. And this brings me to the last slide. So what are the main takeaways of this presentation that you will hopefully remember? Symbolic execution is test generation technique, which allows us to automatically generate test inputs for our software, so we don't have to write these test inputs by hand, and ideally save time. That in comparison to fuzzing, which is an automated software testing technique where the test inputs are randomly generated, symbolic execution generates inputs based on the program structure. So it takes the program structure into account, it reasons about branches in the program, and new inputs generated by a symbolic execution tool trigger new paths in the program, which is not the case for fuzzing, which only uses random input generation. And then similar to fuzzing, symbolic execution has scalability issues. So in reality, it's often not possible to explore all execution paths, so the entire program state. And we often only explore parts of the program state by, for example, running symbolic execution with a fixed time budget, such as 2 days or 1 week or whatever. And I wanted to end this presentation on a little call to action. I wanted to encourage you all to give symbolic execution a try, use it to test your own or other people's software and find and fix some bugs. And in order to ease doing that, I ported the Base46 verification example that I did earlier to a little Git repository, which is available via this URL. And in this Git repository, I've also referenced a few more advanced CLI tutorials that you can try out at home and familiarize yourself with symbolic execution and figure out to which examples it scales and to which examples it does not scale. So if you're interested in that, feel free to check out this URL. It's also referenced in the hackover schedule. There's a link in there, and yeah, feel free to try that at home. And that is it for this talk. If you have any questions, I would be very happy to answer them. Thank you for the attention. So the question was, does it work with strings or char arrays? It does work with strings. If we think about it conceptually, then a string is just a sequence of bytes, right? And we can make a sequence of bytes symbolic, and then it would work on strings just as it does on any other data type. So we use symbolic execution to find optimizations, essentially? Yeah. There are generally a lot of different use cases of symbolic execution. This test generation thing was just the one that I thought would be more or most intuitive for most people. But there are people who use symbolic execution for optimizations as well, to figure out, for example, code that is not reachable. A different, very popular application of symbolic execution is reverse engineering. So people use symbolic execution on binary code to do reverse engineering of code for which no source code is available. That's also very popular. But I haven't personally used it to do these kind of optimizations. But if you go and search the literature for it, then you will definitely find people doing that. Yeah?
Go back to your example. Does it also show
Which one?
The Base64 example.
If you want the coverage, you have to pass some extra compiler flags in order to instrument it for coverage, and then you will be able to get coverage statistics, but I haven't set that up for this example. But you can, of course, do that at home, and there is a CLI documentation on coverage. So in this example, we explore all execution paths. So we get... Yes, we only do all execution paths for 3 bytes. But yes,
so
if...
In the beginning, you motivated that you want to test all the paths, but you need knowledge about the algorithm, so you can know that there is padding.
So that's a very important point. In our example, we only used 3 or 2 bytes, and there is code in there that is not reachable with an input that small. and you would have to figure out what is the size that I need in order to explore the full program space. Yeah, that's definitely the case. I haven't done that here, and ideally you would also. So an important part here is we have a loop that loops over the input, and ideally we would have to ask, have we sufficiently iterated over the loop, right, in order to determine what is the maximum input that we need to test. But all of this stuff I removed here because it's just going too much into the depth. But feel free to experiment with that using the repository. But yeah, very, very important point. Yeah, the we enumerated all execution paths only for this fixed size input. Yes, there might be more if we increase the input size. Yes, very much so. Yeah. So the question is there a limit for the string size? And the answer to that is it depends on what your program does with the strings, right? If you do very branch. Right, but memcompare is just comparing every byte, right? So depending on the size, you would have one comparison for each byte. Yeah, it depends on what your program does with the string. It's very difficult to say that there's an upper limit. It works in any case, but it just takes very long to reason about the computation at some point, depending on what your library does with the string. But in general, it works for arbitrary length strings.
Yeah, in real world code, we have like English file system and there can be bugs like race conditions in there. Does the execution help with these
So the question was, in real-world code, we have interactions with, for example, the file system, and we have race conditions with respect to file interactions. And yeah, that is also a problem domain for symbolic execution. So for example, I could have a symbolic variable, and what happens if I write that symbolic input to a file? What's the semantics then? And symbolic execution tools like CLI, they have their own implementation of the file system API. So they have their own implementation of open and write and read. And CLI, for example, allows you to write symbolic variables to a file. And then when you read from the file, you still get the correctly constrained symbolic variables back because it intercepts the read and write system call API. And the other question is then error detection. So depending on how well you model the file system HPI within these intercepted functions, you could also reason about wrong usage of these APIs, such as concurrency issues. But CLI itself is, I think, not able to reason about concurrency issues with respect to file system interactions, but it does allow you to read and write symbolic bytes, symbolic variables to and from a file by providing a wrapper of this API. Okay, then I think that's it. Thank you for the attention. And yeah, play around with this example.